This is Jonathan Hayfitz, staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project. Today I'm speaking with Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files and Guantanamo, the Definitive Prisoner List. Andy, it's great to be speaking with you. You've been one of the most important chroniclers and commentators on Guantanamo and related detention issues over the past years. This is an incredible resource. You know, the one thing I wanted to ask was, you know, there are other databases out there about Guantanamo and detainees. What makes this database different?
Well, you know, I mean, all credit absolutely to the people who did the work many, many years ago before a large amount of information was made publicly available by the Pentagon. So, you know, I know the Washington Post and the British human rights group Cage Prisoners and some groups in the Middle East spent a long time trying to work out who was there before it was easy to find out who was there at all. You know, because in those first 4 years, as you and I know and everybody who was involved in the process at all, it was extremely difficult to find out even who was being held until the names were released. Now, recently the New York Times went through the documents and did a very useful job in separating out the allegations and transcripts of each individual prisoner. So there is a database there that provides all the allegations and where the prisoners took part, you know, the transcripts of the tribunals and review boards where they answered the allegations against them. It's a very useful resource, but it doesn't provide any context, really. And, you know, my big mission over the last 3 years has been to move beyond seeing the prisoners on a kind of individual case basis where you could look at the government's allegations and think, well, look, they say that this guy did this, this, and this, and to create a context where it's possible for people to have an understanding of the circumstances under which they were captured. Because a lot of the time, you know, that makes quite a big difference as to whether we're looking at somebody who was possibly involved in terrorism and that there would be some context for it. But if we're looking at, for example, prisoners captured in Pakistan, where we have at least somewhere around 100 prisoners who are captured far from the border even of Afghanistan, far from any battlefield, and were generally rounded up because bounty payments were being offered, then we can already see that there's going to be possibly a very large disconnect between the allegations against them and who they actually are, because they were all just about rounded up because opportunistically it was great to seize any Arab in any Pakistani town in the first half of 2002 and sell them to US forces as a terrorist. So it's the context, really, that I hope I've been able to bring to it. And one other important part of the context is the quality of the evidence, whether it's plausible to believe everything that the government says. So the New York Times database, for example, which provides all these documents, doesn't make any attempt to draw any connections between them as to regular allegations that surface where unidentified other prisoners have made allegations against prisoners. And I think that when that's looked at in detail, it's very clear that these allegations are not trustworthy at all and were made by other prisoners either because they were put under duress or some of them were tortured or perhaps more benignly they were encouraged to come up with stories because they were bribed effectively. They were given better living conditions. And the important thing to work out the stories really of what's happened at Guantanamo is to keep looking for these connections and this context. Otherwise, it becomes just a random collection of information, I think, really.
It seems one of the casualties at Guantanamo was not simply due process and human rights, but the truth itself. Does your research lead you to that conclusion?
I think, yes, that's fundamentally true. There are two levels on which things are very badly wrong with Guantanamo, obviously. One is which that even if they had managed to capture Osama bin Laden and all the people closest to him, genuinely dangerous people in significant numbers, which they didn't do, then this was still no way to be treating people, to hold them outside the law, neither as prisoners of war nor as criminals to be put forward for trials. It's compounded and made so much worse by the fact that they didn't get the people that they were supposed to be getting. They got largely either completely innocent people who were in the wrong time at the wrong place, and because these bounty payments were made available, were handed over to U.S. forces, or significant number of Taliban foot soldiers, but these were people who had traveled to Afghanistan before 9/11, before the attacks, to fight other Muslims, essentially the Northern Alliance, the Taliban's opposition in Afghanistan. And this is a kind of crucial error that the administration made in the beginning, was equating the Taliban with Al-Qaeda, because the majority of these men had no connection whatsoever with Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, or international terrorist plots, knew nothing about the 9/11 attacks or any other attacks, and had basically gone on a, what was sold to them, I might have my disagreements with it, and we all might, sold to them as a religious mission to help the Taliban establish a pure Islamic state in Afghanistan. So yeah, the truth has been a horrendous casualty of what's been taking place.
I was wondering if you could talk about one detainee happens to be a client of the ACLU, and where he falls in this spectrum, named Mohammed Jawad.
Okay, well yes, I've been following Mohammed's case for quite some time. I did find out when I was doing my definitive list that he didn't even make it into the final cut of the book, but I think I've made up for that in the years since by writing about him, because Mohammed was a teenager at the time that he was seized in a marketplace in Kabul in December 2002 after a grenade attack on a jeep containing two US soldiers and an Afghan interpreter. And for some time, obviously, he was in Guantanamo along with all the other prisoners, with the authorities not really necessarily knowing even who they had there. I think it's important for people to know that at the beginning, they really had no idea who the majority of the prisoners were, and Brigadier General Mike Leonard of the Marines, who ran the base at the beginning, is on record as saying that, that they'd identified a small number as Al-Qaeda, a slightly larger number as the Taliban, and a considerably vaster number in the middle that they had no idea about. It helps to explain why they basically had blank slates as prisoners and then had to graft allegations onto them. So for some time, I think Mohammed Jawad, like so many of the other Afghans, was really held in this position. And then when they started fishing around for prisoners that they felt that they could mount successful prosecutions against in the military commission trial system, which to my understanding was the particular brainchild of Vice President Dick Cheney and his closest legal advisor, David Addington. For some reason, they decided that Jawad would be a good case. Now, what they had against him, and this has emerged over the years, is that he had been captured by Afghan forces and had made a confession after he was captured and was then handed over very swiftly to US forces and repeated his confession. It took a long time for it to be revealed that he had been severely threatened when he made that confession, and that actually it took a judge finally to decide that it had been torture that had been used on him. But there were so many other extraordinary problems with the case of Mohammed Jawad, as with the case of Omar Khadr, the Canadian, who was also put forward for trial by military commission, because both of these guys were teenagers when they were captured. They were under 18. Omar was 15 and Mohammed 16 or 17 at the time of his capture. Now, according to the UN optional protocol on the rights of the child for juveniles in wartime, these people were supposed to have been rehabilitated rather than subjected to the kind of horrendous punishment that they've both been subjected to. And I've always been amazed that the Bush administration, when it was really testing the waters to see whether its novel trial system would work, that it put forward two juveniles so soon. In the eye of the world, where prosecuting juveniles is really not acceptable, they thought that this was appropriate behavior. It always amazed me.
Thanks for listening to this ACLU podcast. To learn more about the ACLU's work around Guantanamo and indefinite detention, go to aclu.org/detention. To learn more about Andy Worthington's book, go to andyworthington.co.uk.